French health minister says new COVID-19 infections are increasing at an unprecedented rate due to the Delta variant after France's daily cases hit 18,000. The death toll in Europe's massive floods jumped to 200, with at least 169 people dead in Germany alone. Muslim pilgrims perform a major ritual of a scaled-back Hajj near the Saudi city of Mecca. The annual event is reaching its climax. This is World News with me, Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. Now starting with the COVID situation, the French health minister says that new COVID infections are increasing at an unprecedented rate due to the Delta variant after its daily cases hit a record number of 18,000.
I just received the figures for new infections in our country over the last 24 hours. I had spoken of the risk of reaching 15 to 20,000 cases per day at the end of the month of July. Yesterday, there were 18,000 new infections in only 24 hours. It means that the spread of the virus has increased by 150% over a week. We have never seen this before, not with COVID, neither with the English variant, nor the South African, nor the Brazilian.
In a parliament meeting, the official backed the new rules aimed at pressuring millions of vaccine holdouts into getting a jab, saying it's the only way to contain infections. The French government is set to institute new measures, such as requiring a health pass in a wide array of venues from the beginning of August. However, the announcement of the measures has also sparked a backlash, with thousands protesting across the country on Saturday against what they call the country's vaccine dictatorship. The level of infections is the highest since mid-May, when the country was emerging from a third nationwide lockdown. Former aide to British Prime Minister has revealed that Boris Johnson held out on imposing a second lockdown last autumn, arguing that most of those dying were over 80.
His attitude at that point was a weird mix of partly it's all nonsense and lockdowns don't work anyway, and partly, well, this is terrible, but the people who are dying are essentially all over 80, and we can't kill the economy just because of people dying over 80.
In a TV interview, Cummings, now Johnson's bitter foe, accused the Prime Minister of putting his own political interests ahead of people's lives. He said his former boss had wanted to let COVID wash through the country rather than wreck the economy. Cummings also shared private WhatsApp messages in which Johnson joked that the elderly could get COVID and live longer. The Premier also denied that the contagion would overwhelm the country's national health system. A Labour Party MP called the revelations shocking and demanded immediate public inquiry into Johnson's handling of the pandemic. Iran has reported more than 27,000 new coronavirus infections. That's the highest since the pandemic began earlier last year. Health ministry said that the new figure pushes the caseload to more than 3.5 million. 250 more people also succumbed to the disease, taking the death toll to 87,000. The National Virus Task Force has implemented restrictions to stem the deadly virus. It's ordered government offices and banks in Tehran and Elbourz provinces to close for 6 days as of Monday. Restrictions also include a ban on road travel to and from the two provinces. High-risk businesses have also been shut down across worst-hit areas. At least 169 people are now confirmed to have died in the devastating floods in Germany, the country's worst natural disaster in more than half a century. And that brings the total number of deaths in Western Europe to at least 200. The death toll could still rise, as many people are still unaccounted for. The European floods struck on Wednesday. The deluge mainly hit Germany's western states and parts of Belgium. Entire communities have been cut off without power or communication. The German government has dismissed criticism about its warning systems, and that after opposition politicians said that the number of fatalities from the torrential rains and widespread flooding revealed the failings of Germany's preparedness. A national day of mourning has commenced in Belgium for people who lost their lives in severe floods. Days of torrential rain last week killed dozens of people in Western Europe, while many are still missing. Our correspondent Jerome Hughes has traveled to some of the worst affected areas in Eastern Belgium.
The village of Vosso-Chevremont on the outskirts of Liège has been devastated. Seven people lost their lives in last week's floods here. Hundreds have been forced to flee their homes.
When the water comes, I see it in my foot. I say, well, okay, we go home. But the water not in my foot come here, and I don't know what to say.
Meteorologists claim 2 months' rain fell here in just 2 days. It's being described as the worst natural disaster for eastern Belgium and western Germany in living memory. However, how natural is it? Climate change is being blamed. Also, there is criticism surrounding planning. Many towns and villages in Europe were constructed on floodplains. Some residents have been told it could be up to 8 months before their homes will be habitable again.
We lost our fridge. We don't even know where he is. He disappeared in the river. Everything is damaged. We have to do everything again.
There was also severe flooding in Netherlands, France and Luxembourg, but there's no doubt Germany and Belgium were hit hardest. Many thousands of homes that were not destroyed are still without electricity, water and gas supplies. It might take weeks before those are restored. Aside from the tragic loss of life, the floods have caused billions of euro worth of damage. Serious questions surround the effectiveness of the EU's flood warning system. Reviews will now be conducted to find out if all this human suffering could have been avoided.
When we get out of the house was the worst moment, because we have the feeling that we have lost everything and let it there and don't save anything.
The European Commission says it stands ready to provide whatever assistance is required. Throughout Tuesday, flags will be flown at half-mast in Belgium as the country observes a national day of mourning. Jerome Hughes in the village of Vosso-Chevremont, Belgium.
Some 100,000 Palestinians have performed prayers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound to mark Eid al-Adha, the Feast of Sacrifice. The prayers were held amid tight restrictions at a holy site in the occupied Al-Quds. The Salafi regime tightened a curb several days before the Muslim religious festival, launching crackdown on Palestinians there. The prayers at the Al-Aqsa are part of ceremonies by Muslims worldwide to celebrate Eid al-Adha. That marks the end of the Hajj pilgrimage. As part of the celebrations, Muslims visit friends and relatives too. Some also sacrifice animals like camels and sheep and donate their meat as charity. The practice aims to honor Prophet Abraham for his willingness to sacrifice his son as an act of obedience to God's command.
The morning of Eid al-Adha, Yemenis from all walks of life came together in front of the United Nations office in Yemen's capital Sana'a to call on the international community to redouble efforts to pressure Saudi Arabia into lifting the blockade imposed on the country.
We are here for the sixth day, demonstrating in front of the United Nations office in Sana'a. The international body has not fulfilled its duty towards the Yemeni people. More than 6 years have passed and we have been subjected to an absurd war that killed thousands of Yemenis. We demand the international community to lift the siege imposed on the Yemeni people and release the oil ships that have already obtained entry permits by the United Nations.
Protesters blasted the United Nations for remaining silent toward the Saudi suffocating siege on Yemen. They called on the international community to take real measures to stop the Saudi piracy against Yemeni oil ships.
We are still protesting in front of the United Nations office, especially on religious occasions, in order to expose to the world the complicity between the United Nations and the Saudi-led coalition, including piracy against Yemeni oil ships despite obtaining UN permits.
Since June 2020, Yemenis have been suffering from a harsh shortage of fuel due to the continued illegal seizure of Yemeni oil vessels by Saudi Arabia. The fuel crisis has heavily affected the health sector and left the war-torn country in a desperate struggle to survive.
After 6 years of war and blockade, Yemenis say the United Nations has not yet done anything to stop Saudi actions against their country. They accuse the international body of providing political cover for Riyadh's violations of international law. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Muslim pilgrims have conducted a major Hajj ritual near the Saudi city of Mecca. As the annual event has reached its climax, worshippers wearing simple white clothes threw pebbles at a devil symbolically in the tent city of Mina. The rite to stone a devil will be repeated for the next 2 days. After the third day of stoning, pilgrims will stream back to Mecca to pray at a grand mosque at the end of the Hajj. The annual ceremony usually brings to Saudi Arabia some 2.5 million people from all over the world. But for the second year, it was downsized due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Only 60,000 residents picked via lottery are taking part in this year's Hajj. In London. And also we have Charles Orter, private investor and writer, joining us out of New York.
Well, I think there's quite a lot of these currencies that people have bought for speculative purposes. They think they're digital gold. They think they're going to appreciate in value. And that's the main reason for holding them, because you can't spend them at the shops very easily, and you really can't use them for a lot of transactions. And, of course, they've gone up an awful lot in the last 10 years. You know, if you bought Bitcoin, it was 10 cents in 2011. So, you know, to be $30,000 today is quite incredible. And these kind of returns don't last. And I'm afraid some people have bought at the top of the market. They're now beginning to suffer. And as the price continues to fall, because it is a bubble, then, you know, people will not enter the market. And I think you're going to see the risk side as well. You don't get these dramatic returns without some risk.
Now, Charles, what's happened in the U.S.? Well, I told you about China, the central bank, urging the payment firms and banks also to crack down on this. What's the U.S. doing about this? Is the U.S. also worried about cryptocurrencies?
Well, I mean, the U.S. markets have bounced back this morning and very sharply. I think to see what's going on, you've got to go in two directions, in my opinion. First, you've got to examine the period after December 31st, 2008. That's the period when our central bank, the British Central Bank, and others have artificially suppressed benchmark interest rates, inflating gigantic bubbles around the world. This follows on a period where these benchmark interest rates have been declining steadily ever since 1981. Mm-hmm. In that environment, value-oriented investors are happy to see the value of everything they own go up, but the market appears to be very, very overvalued and people get skeptical. That's the legitimate investment. In addition to them, you have the people who produce dirty money, the criminals, the charity fraudsters, people stealing money. They need to convert dirty money into clean money. And my strong suspicion is that one way they're doing that is with these cryptocurrencies, and frankly, you don't have good visibility into the total stock of them. There's no real empowered regulator of them. And therefore, it's easy to turn dirty money into clean money by buying, trading, and speculating in these cryptocurrencies.
Professor Bilding, do you also share the same view that money laundering could be done through a cryptocurrency easily?
Well, it's very easy, actually, because there are anonymous currencies like Zcash, and you basically can't even track who owns it. And that's very difficult to keep track of. And then, you know, you can switch from one of those to where there's another one called Monero, and you can switch into that one as well from the Zcash. I mean, so it is very difficult to track who actually owns what in this area. And, of course, there are some people that own an awful lot of these coins. And you don't know how they're behaving. And many of them, of course, can't get out in one go, but they can get out slowly over time. And they've attracted a lot of people into this market, okay? Normally what I call rational people have been entering this market thinking they're going to make spectacular gains, and many people have, by the way. Mm-hmm. But the bubble has probably popped now, and there's going to be a lot of downside, even more than we currently are, because if you look at it, this bubble took off again, you know, last year, at the end of last year. You know, people were amazed when it got back to 20,000. It's still 50% above the 20,000, which was the previous peak. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the downside will be very interesting, how deep it is and how much panic actually sets in. And there's things like Tethercoin that many people suspect could have fraud behind it. You know, are they really backed $60 billion with real $60 billion of assets? No one really knows. So there are real dangers in this market as well.
Okay, thank you very much for your comments. Keith Bilbin, Professor of International Economics and Finance with City University, joining me from London. And also, we had Charles Orter, private investor and writer, who joined us from New York with his comments. China has slammed the U.S. for its, quote, fabricated allegations that Beijing was behind a massive cyber attack on Microsoft in March.
The U.S. has mustered its allies to carry out unreasonable criticism against China on the issue of cybersecurity. This move is fabricated out of nothing, confuses right and wrong, and is an act of smearing and oppression that's wholly motivated by political purposes. China will never accept it.
The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman says his country resolutely opposes and combats any form of cyber attacks and will never support them. On Monday, the United States and its allies, including New Zealand and Australia, accused China of hacking Microsoft Exchange. It's an email platform used by corporations around the world. They also accused China of a global espionage campaign. Also on Monday, the U.S. State Department charged four Chinese nationals with what are called the malicious hacking. The world's richest man, Jeff Bezos, has spent a few minutes in space in the first human mission of a Blue Origin's reusable New Shepard craft. Jeff's brother, a pioneer of the space race and a student, accompanied him in an adventurous journey. The spacecraft, built by Bezos' own company, Blue Origin, lifted off from a private launch site in Texas. After 2 minutes, the capsule separated from the rocket, continuing upwards to the most widely recognized boundary of space, the Kármán line. The capsule reached an altitude of 107 kilometers. 11 minutes later, it landed on Earth safely. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
Dear listeners, we're going to continue discussing Imam Khomeini's testament. As a reminder, we said that Imam Khomeini strongly believed that religion is intermingled with government and that Islam can properly cope with the requirements of time. He did his best to expose those hands which were trying to show Islam as inefficient to administer society. Please stay with us. The founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, used to say that the enemies are hell-bent on portraying the Islamic Republic as incompetent in tackling social problems. He wrote in his testament, "Of these kinds of plots, and maybe more wicked, are the widespread rumors in the country and provinces saying that the Islamic Republic has done nothing for the people. Poor people have sacrificed enthusiastically to get rid of the rebellious, oppressive regime. Yet, they have been beleaguered by a worse regime. The arrogant have become more arrogant, and the oppressed have become more oppressed. The prisons are full of young people who are the hope of the country's future, and tortures are worse and more inhumane than the former regime. Every day, some people are executed in the name of Islam. One wishes that the name of Islam was not put on this republic. This era is worse than the era of Reza Khan and his son. People are plunged in suffering, trouble, and skyrocketing inflation, while the ringleaders are directing this regime towards a communist regime. People's properties are seized and freedom has been prohibited for the nation in everything, and many other such-like affairs that are being put into effect with a scheme. The founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, believed that lack of information on the situation of other countries and the fate of other revolutions has caused the plots of enemies to be effective in deceiving some people in Iran. He wrote in his testament, "The basis of the issue is that many of them who hear these things and believe them are unaware of the situation in other parts of the world, the revolutions, the post-revolution events, and its great inevitable hardships. I recommend to them not to embark on finding faults, vitriolic criticism and insulting before studying the current situation of the world and comparison of Iran's Islamic revolution with other revolutions, and before familiarity with the situation of the countries and nations to see what would happen to them during the revolution and after their revolution, and before heeding the hardships of this country that has been under the rebellious rule of Reza Khan, and worse than that, Mohammad Reza, who have bequeathed to this government during their pillage, and before examining the performance of the government and the Jihad Construction Organization in deprived villages and comparing it with the former regime, along with considering the hardships of the imposed war and its consequences, such as million-strong homeless, families of martyrs, the war-stricken, million-strong Afghan and Iraqi refugees, and with regards to the economic siege and continuous conspiracies of the United States and their external affiliates. Isn't it better to try to reform and help instead of repressing?" Imam Khomeini continued in his testament by saying, "I have never said and don't say that today, in the Islamic Republic of Iran, the great Islam is being implemented with all its dimensions. And some persons do not do against the rules of Islam out of ignorance, grudge, and lack of discipline. I rather say that the legislature, the judiciary, and the executive branches of government are making strenuous efforts to Islamize the country, and the 10 million strong nation is also their supporter and helper. And if this fault-finding and obstructionist minority rush to help, these ideals would materialize easier and faster. And if the Almighty God forbid, they do not come to their senses, as the million-strong masses have woken up and pay attention to the issues and are present in the scene, the humane Islamic ideals will spectacularly be put into effect, God willing. And the stray and the fault-finding will not be able to resist against this raging flood." Another excerpt from Imam Khomeini's last will and testament reads, "I firmly claim that the Iranian nation and its million-strong masses are better off than the nation of Hejaz in the time of the Messenger of God. Blessings of God upon him and his progeny, and the people of Kufa in Iraq in the time of the command of the faithful Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib and Hussein ibn Ali, blessings and greetings of God upon them. The Hijaz were in the time of the Messenger of God, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Even Muslims would not obey him and would not go to the front with pretext, so that Almighty God reprimanded them and promised punishment for them in ayahs of the Surah Tawbah in the Holy Quran. And the people of Iraq, the people of Kufa, who misbehaved the commander of the faithful and disobeyed him to the extent that his complaints are famous in the books of narration and history. And those Muslims in Iraq, in the city of Kufa, who caused what happened to the master of martyrs, Imam Hussein, peace be upon him. And those who didn't submerge their hand in his martyrdom either fled the battlefield or sat so that the crime of history occurred. But today we can see that the Iranian nation, from the military, law enforcement, IRGC and Basij volunteer forces to popular forces of volunteers and the forces in the fronts and the people in the back of fronts, embark on such sacrifices and epics. And we can see what valuable aids the respectable people across the country have granted. And we can see that the survivors of martyrs and the war-stricken and their relatives face us and you with epical visages and enthusiastic and assuring words and deeds. And all of these stem from their full love, attachment and faith in Almighty God, their faith in Islam and perpetual life. This is while they are neither in the blessed presence of the noble Prophet, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, nor are they in presence of the infallible Imam, blessings of God upon him. Their motive is their faith and trust in the unseen. But this is the mystery of success and victory in different dimensions. Founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the late Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, calls on young people who have been deceived by enemies and hypocrites to think fairly and freely. He says in his testament and will, "I recommend that young people, both girls and boys who have been exploited by hypocrites and opportunistic and profiteering deviants, to judge impartially and free thought the propaganda of those who want the Islamic Republic to be destroyed, and the quality of their practice and their behavior with deprived masses, and also their morals, and their behavior among themselves and their advocates, and their change of stances in various events, and carefully and without mean desire, examine and study the state of those who were martyred in the Islamic Republic by hypocrites and deviants, and evaluate between them and their enemies to see which group is the advocate of the deprived and oppressed in society." Well, dear listeners, next time we will continue with other parts of Imam Khomeini's testament. Until our next program, goodbye and God bless.
Dark Review.
Hello. Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Shadow World, directed by Johan Grimman Perez. And joining me in the studio, we have Maria Duarte, who is a film critic for the Morning Star newspaper and who has also worked as a news journalist. And beside her is Tete Kofi, who is a journalist and broadcaster. Now, Shadow World gives you an alarming behind-the-scenes tale of the global arms trade, revealing the complicity of the US and British governments working with corrupt regimes in the world, and how this determines economic and foreign policies, undermines democracy, and creates widespread suffering. And in shedding light on how our realities are being constructed, the film also offers a way for audiences to see through this horror in the hopes of creating a better future.
I've got nothing against money. I don't mind paying bribes to politicians. The thing about politicians is that they're very much like prostitutes, but only more expensive.
The heads of government are the salespeople in chief of their country's large arms contractors.
For the last 50 years at least, policy has been made based on the assumption of greed, and it's ruined the world.
This very phrase, war on terror,
it's nonsense.
It's like saying a war on war. You're slipping into this possibility of kind of perpetual war.
The national security state not only seeks a perpetual state of war, it will even go to all ends to create that.
They make the mafia look like a bunch of schoolboys.
And it destroys diplomacy. It destroys the will to diplomacy, and it destroys the skill for diplomacy.
Bombs, they're like food. Munitions, that's got, you know, sell-by date. You gotta get rid of it.
Blair came to South Africa to lobby that BAE, the British weapons manufacturer, won the biggest contract, $10 billion. Quite scarce public resources on this weaponry that we didn't need.
BAE had channeled international covert payments all over the world to the local politicians.
Seems to be a very expensive way of organising bribe payment. Might as well cut out the military equipment and just hand out the money.
It's the disease of permanent war that destroyed the Middle East, not Islamic fundamentalism.
Companies are not only sort of part of the government, but they're effectively above the law.
It's okay to kill from a distance without a warrant, without a trial, without a jury, and the execution takes place on screen.
Once you start a war, you open a kind of Pandora's box. You don't control it, it controls you. And it propels you in directions you never thought you'd go.
Well, first of all, a very warm welcome to you both. Thanks very much for coming on. So this documentary was a very politically charged film and also quite very eye-opening and covers a lot of ground about the global arms industry, which is a trillion-dollar industry. Maria, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what's your take on Shadow World?
Well, it's a very detailed, comprehensive look at the exploration of the arms deal, which seems to rally its audience into political action. I didn't feel that it did anything particularly shattering, but what it did was it kind of crossed the T's and dotted the I's. And then it also tried to be a bit sort of poetic. So we have all these numerous talking heads, but they're peppered with these poetic and melodic extracts from Eduardo Galeano's stories. And in that way, the filmmaker trying to make it somewhat more cinematic because it is a lot to digest.
And of course, it could serve as a comprehensive guide for those who don't know much about this topic.
No, exactly. It's not quite the idiot's guide to arms deal, but it is very intelligently done, very exquisitely edited, and it does give you sort of a very potted history at the issues behind it.
And Tete, if I could turn to you now, what was your take on this film?
Well, trying to understand the arms industry and actually the way of real politics today, without watching this film, it's like trying to understand Hamlet without a crib sheet. You don't understand the language, you don't understand the idioms, you don't understand the context within which everything is being done, and so you probably won't have comprehension. I found this
film... Of course, that's a lot to ask to squeeze into a 90-odd minute film.
Well, and I always ask myself first, look, did he need 90 minutes? And I think, yes, he did, and he used the 90 minutes extremely well, because ultimately... For any cinematic experience, I'd walk away with what was the impact. The impact was I'm really pleased I had breakfast before I watched this movie, because I felt a little bit dirty after watching it. A little bit like
And why was that?
Yeah. Because all of it was so kind of resonant with me of why things are in the world they are today. And it's happening in broad daylight.
And of course, you were saying how there were talking heads in this, but they weren't just any talking heads. They were very high-profile interviews. You had top journalists like Robert Fisk, senior American politicians.
Yes, and you also had that arms dealer, which apparently was very difficult to get hold of an arms dealer to come into the film, because the director said that the first rough cut was 4.5 hours long, and he'd interviewed 50 people and kind of condensed it to 15. But with people like the arms dealer, it kind of adds more, it adds colour, because at the end of the day, they are just talking heads.
Mm. I mean, at the beginning, what absolutely got me bolt upright was a banal statement like, actually, when you're doing an arms deal, your secretary's ass could give you the edge. Then later on in the clip you showed, where he said that politicians are like prostitutes, it's just that they're a little bit more expensive. It's the banality of that world which actually ordinary people in the street cannot believe can be happening in the world of multi-million dollar corporations and the heads of state who we voted to put in place.
Mm-hmm. So Shadow World's an apt name indeed for the documentary. But we'll just have to move swiftly on just for now.
This is an impressive crowd, the haves and the have-mores.
Cheney commissioned a study by Halliburton to find out how much more of the Defense Department could be privatized.
Halliburton, proud to serve our troops.
Halliburton was elated to get this million-dollar contract and, of course, returned a verdict that, oh, Mr. Secretary, lots more of it can be privatized.
Dick Cheney leaves the Defense Department and goes and heads Halliburton himself. And he spends the entire 1990s building up the Halliburton war empire.
Well, if we're going to talk about Star Wars, we might as well invite Darth Vader. I'm happy to accept.
Then he comes back into power as vice president, and then they start hiring Halliburton to, you know, in advance even of U.S. troops going into Iraq, Halliburton personnel and equipment was being deployed to the Gulf. It's hard to look at this and not say these guys had a very long-term plan for how they were going to increase the powerful infrastructure of private companies. What we've essentially done is to create a network of corporations that have the firepower of small nation states that could, you know, overthrow some small governments around the world.
In essence, we in the United States have privatized the ultimate public function, war.
Really, you believe there's no such thing as coincidences. Marie, what was your reaction to connections being made between the U.S. military, the government, and oil companies, and what else does the documentary suggest about the ulterior motives of the government?
Well, part of me was shocked. Part of me was resigned to this hideous, dark shadow world, as it's described, and that we have no power to do anything about it, because all this is done behind closed doors, you know. It's all about sweeteners and kickbacks. And as it said in the film, that war is a commodity. And it doesn't matter how many people die, the longer that lasts, the more money people make, whether it be at the top of government or, you know, these arms dealers. It's disgusting. It's appalling. And you do feel dirty afterwards, but you kind of feel powerless. And the film doesn't really give you an alternative.
Perhaps there is no alternative in real life there.
Maybe not. Of course, now with the Trump administration, we would hope that there isn't that secrecy, because he does everything via Twitter, and we have the biggest arms deal. I'm putting that in inverted commas because he hasn't said that. But, you know, back in the Reagan era and Thatcher and all those, it was all done secretively.
Which is highlighted in the documentary.
Yeah, and even up to Obama, which
That was quite surprising, but not because it's government, so they can do whatever they want, really.
And Tete, if I could turn to you, would you agree with what Maria said, and what did you make of these connections being made?
Very much. I mean, I split the movie, The Doc, into three parts. Part one was the arrogant vulgarity and banality of it with the arms dealer, making their statements about politicians and prostitutes, things like that. The bit where they showed a whole Saudi sultan being given a commercial airliner, and the banality of him painting it in his favourite American football colours. I mean, if I was a Man U supporter, I'd have liveried it up in red, for example. Then the second part is that it goes into the culture and the rationales which are given to enable this to happen, and the institutions that support that culture, which is what we've just basically watched. Now, I could not help but expand this documentary into history, and I place at the start point towards the civilization we have now reached at the start of the transatlantic slave trade, because this was the first time an activity, slavery, has been known since the dawn of civilization, but this was the first time it was actually industrialized. And with the industrialization, you had to create a philosophy and a culture which enabled it to go on, fly in plain sight with the support of ordinary people. And this is the bit that this documentary does so extremely well.
Well, that's a fascinating point, but I'm afraid we'll have to move swiftly on, and we'll pick up your next point in the next part of the discussion.
I denounced the call to invade Iraq publicly. The New York Times issued me a formal written reprimand, which is what you get before you're fired under union rules to stop speaking out against the war. I'd been the Middle East bureau chief. I mean, I'd been in Iraq. I'd been 7 years in the Middle East. How can you come out of Gaza and not be angry? What's being done to those people? How can you come out of the Sudan, El Salvador, you know, dozens of other places I've been, and not be angry? I've seen the bodies of a lot of children, which I can't forget. Dostoevsky said, hell is the inability to love, and that's what kills people. I fully get why people blow their brains out. It's really hell. And I don't use love as a kind of hallmark schmaltzy, you know, we all gotta love each other. I'm saying that the only way you're healed from those experiences is by reestablishing a connection with that kind of power, with another human being. And if you can't do that, you don't survive. And I have friends who couldn't do it, and they're not here anymore.
Very emotional account there. Maria, do you get a sense from this documentary that there is a lot of frustration and a lack of support for these ongoing wars?
Well, there is, but the problem is, and what the governments do so insidiously, is to instill terror and fear into the populace. And so that gives them carte blanche to do what they want militarily. And so people sort of believe what the government tells them. And so we're in this vicious circle that correspondents, brave correspondents, like you've just seen, try to get the truth out there. And they're literally, you know, smacked down. And they try to gag them. Mm-hmm. And that's appalling. And it shouldn't happen, but it does. And it's still happening today. Mm-hmm.
And it reminds me, actually, Claire Short, former Labour politician, she says that the war on terror is sort of almost like a manufactured concept to keep the sort of perpetual wars, and it's sort of used as a scapegoat. Would you agree with that, Tessa?
Well, a marketing man's dream is a product that creates demand for itself. It becomes a perpetual motion machine, and you can't stop it. And I call this part of the documentary the state capture bit. That's the expression we actually use in South Africa for when private people latch onto the state and leech off it. Because that's what's happened with the arms companies and their lobbyists, is that actually they are running the state. And that's why that arms dealer can say that the politicians don't run anything, they're just more expensive than prostitutes. It's the banality of that. And I think that at the end, this documentary works because of the sense of outrage. It can fire up in people. Some people will also just feel, what's the point? I give up. We don't stand a chance. But many, many people will be outraged just by being able to join the dots of the fact that these private contractors have got a stranglehold on government. And actually what government does is as a result of what is profitable to the contractor. And some of the governments, of course, people are corrupt. Imagine the ANC taking that massive...
African National Congress.
Yeah. Taking that massive kickback when hundreds of thousands of poor, ordinary Africans' lives could have been saved with retroviral drugs. But they went for that because the ANC wanted to stay back.
Well, going back to the documentary, and a really fascinating point you made, there's four main targets, I suppose, of the documentary seems to be the US, the UK, Saudi Arabia, and Israel. How are the four countries portrayed in this documentary, Maria, and how are they connected?
Well, they're not portrayed terribly well, really, because they're in it for the money. You've seen Blair, who brought in new labour and was, you know, the spiritual light here who's going to bring all this hope, and yet, you know, he was in it for the money. He was getting, kickbacks and stuff, allegedly. But what was interesting there is that the influence that the Saudi royal family had on him, and where you had Prince Bandar come over and say, hold on, the serious fraud office, I believe. Sorry, having this investigation into these crimes, and they were getting very close to him. And he said, no, you need to stop this, otherwise, we're going to remove the security and there's going to be blood on the streets of London. And then you have Blair turning round and basically the guy says, jump, and Blair says, well, how high, more or less? That's disgusting, really.
And he
got away with it. But then he was, you know, Teflon Tony, you know, nothing stuck to him. And it's the same with all the other countries. You know, what surprised me was that they didn't look at the drone warfare, and also cyber warfare, which is now becoming...
They're documentaries in their own right.
And we've probably covered that already. The thing is that all these countries, nothing kind of surprised me about it, that they were all interlinked. They don't come out very well from the documentary, and if you didn't think well of them, then it will compound what you thought. It's speaking to the converted, really.
Well, this takes us... That's a really good, great point. We're just going to move on again.
Fiscal year 1999, 2.3 trillion missing. Fiscal year 2000, 1.1 trillion missing. The Pentagon has claimed year after year that the reason it can't account for the money is because its computers don't communicate with each other.
1 trillion $1 bills stacked high would reach nearly 68,000 miles into space, one-third of the way to the moon.
I got a phone call from the FBI saying that I was a target of a death threat. And that's what happens when you go against the big boys.
Who has the contracts today to make those systems communicate with each other? And how much have the taxpayers paid for them?
There are times that corporations do things they should not do, in which case they tend to be suspended for some period. There are times then that corporations can get out of the penalty box,
This company was never in the penalty box. If you could proceed to my second question, please.
The second question, I've forgotten what the second question was.
Individuals operating in the shadows and never having their names called are able to leverage the power of the military and the foreign policy apparatus for their own personal pecuniary ends.
What now? Who's the enemy? How do we justify all these tanks, all these planes, all this bullshit?
What better new enemy than an hypothetical, invisible enemy called the War on Terror?
Rumsfeld looked quite smug and incompetent there. Maria, I heard you laugh. Why was that?
Because he wasn't incompetent. He knew exactly what he was doing, and he knew he could get away with it. And he has, you know. And that poor woman was the one that was then... ostracized and found it very difficult later on in her career.
So these people get away with it. That's the problem. And it's wrong, but what can you do? What can we do?
And Tete, would you agree with Maria? How do you think of how Rumsfeld was portrayed in the documentary, and was it accurate depiction?
Well, the funny thing, when I was watching it, I actually thought it took me back to one of the scenes in the Godfather movies when the mafia bosses are lined up in front of a, I think it was a grand jury or a commission of some sort, and the smugness with which they behave literally said that whoever's asking the questions, I own your boss. So, and it's the confidence of knowing that they could, he could pull her leash in at any time that he wanted, and sure enough, she's got death threats by the FBI. Whether they're true or false, it's almost lethal pressure to make sure that these people comply. It's extremely difficult, but I actually feel that you can over-egg the pudding to a point. And with the confluence of certain events in world affairs, the nationalism that's rising in Europe, Brexit that's happened in Britain, Trump and all the excesses that he's associated with, I think actually we have reached a turning point in which many of these old ways will not be able to function in the way they did before.
So this documentary raises greater and greater questions and makes us question society. Do you think this is a testament to the documentary then, Maria?
I think so. Like I said earlier, it doesn't really reveal anything new, but
it's certainly thought-provoking.
But it's thought-provoking, and it makes you think, and it kind of joins all the dots, basically, because we knew all this. But when you see it there in black and white or in colour, it's slightly different, and it does make you really angry. You know, you end up screaming at the screen because it's so frustrating that these people, on the face of it, got away with it. And
so, just your final thoughts on the film?
But you see, the interesting thing is that there is another documentary that follows this, which will have to put the last piece of the jigsaw in place, which is that actually our collective standard of living is built on the excesses we're seeing in this movie. And it is, I think, when that story is told, the people will connect the fact that actually there isn't so much of an otherness around somebody who behaves like a gangster in creating public policy, and the car that I'm driving on the street, and the fact that my salary is what it is. All of this thing has a cyclical kind of connection, and people will start to join those dots as well.
Well, it's a very powerful note to end it on. I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there as we've run out of time. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you both to my guests and to you. I've been Camilla Shambayati.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Heartbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.